Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Dan Grossman. He's a freelance environmental journalist with a host of awards and prestigious support to his name, including a Peabody Award and the National Science Foundation and the Fund for Investigative Journalism. He also has a PhD in political science from MIT. His work has regularly appeared on NPR and the BBC, among other venues, and he's written for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, and Scientific American. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, the main topic I want to explore with you is the way that citizens get their scientific information and how that information is treated and communicated in a politically charged environment, which we're obviously living in a politically charged environment these days. So let me start with global warming. It's one of the big things that you've been reporting on. There seems to be a clear scientific consensus on this issue. Al Gore won the Nobel Prize for his work on this and so on. Yet the controversy over whether this is real persists. So what's going on here?
Let me start by saying that there's no question that there is a scientific consensus that global warming is real and that people are a major or at least a large part of the cause. That is... We've gotten to the point in the science where it's almost like saying that the Earth is flat to say that global warming is not happening. The science there is settled. So the so-called controversy is not a controversy among scientists. It's a controversy that is a synthetic controversy. It's a controversy made by people who don't want us to understand the reality of global warming. To be blunt about it, it's not in the interests of some people that the world address the global warming problem. The global warming problem is only going to be addressed by burning less fossil fuel. That means oil, natural gas, and coal. That's the only way it's going to be addressed. There are some tweaks that can be made. In addition to that, like you can capture some of the carbon dioxide in the air and store it underground. But that's not going to solve the problem. That's not going to solve the whole problem. We need to burn less of this fuel. And if you happen to be a provider of fuel, well, that doesn't sound like such a hot idea.
Well, the reason why I wanted to ask that question to you is because you're an environmental journalist, and you seem to have crafted a niche, among others, for finding, I think, particularly effective and interesting ways to communicate what's going on scientifically to your audience and to your listeners. And so in some ways, I guess I see you as both an adventurer, and we'll get into that, but also a translator of sorts for folks. And so I thought perhaps you might have some insight as to this process of how what appears at one level to be something which is non-controversial becomes so controversial when it starts being talked about in the media.
Well, you mentioned, the kind of work I'm doing. My view is, I look around. I think that climate change is the problem of this century. It's a problem that we have to come to terms with. It could be an existential problem, a problem that actually threatens our very existence. Mm. We're talking about huge changes in sea level rise, all sorts of different things. And yet I look around and people don't seem that interested in it. And I can't understand it. Why wouldn't people be interested in something that's so threatening to them and to subsequent generations, to their kids and their grandkids? When you have very powerful people saying, like Rick Perry, saying that climate change is a hoax, well, that immediately makes it politically acceptable to question something that is otherwise beyond question. There are lots of people. It's not just Rick Perry who's saying this. There are interest groups dedicated to making climate change seem more confusing than it is. And he's gotten entangled in that for whatever reason. I don't understand the politics. And the Republican Party, for some reason, has embraced being against climate change as sort of part of its platform. It doesn't make very much sense that one party should be identified with a particular understanding of a branch of science. That just doesn't make much sense, especially when certifiably that's false, that what they're saying is not true. So it's hard to understand, and the only way I can understand it is that there are powerful interests, and I'm talking about the fossil fuel extractive industries that don't want us to deal with this problem.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Dan Grossman, a freelance environmental journalist who reports on climate change. Well, let me flip that around and ask you, do you think that there are common mistakes that scientists make when they are trying to communicate their work to a broader audience? And what would those be?
Scientists are not in general good communicators. Now, I've met many scientists who are great communicators, and scientists are not always sort of these nerdy people who are uneasy in public. I've met lots of scientists who are fun to be around, who are interesting, but generally they're not great communicators, and generally, they don't see it as their job to communicate. They're scientists. That's what they're doing. They're doing research. Why should they have to get up and crow about, some area of research they're doing or some area of science? Now, that's changing, and some are seeing the benefit and value of it, first because they're all very frustrated that the public has such a poor understanding of this topic, and they also realize that for most of them, their research is paid for by public funds, and so it's important to be communicating what they're doing and who paid for it, because there's less and less appreciation for what the public funding is doing for our country.
I'm Grant Reher, and you're listening to the Campbell Conversations. We'll continue the conversation in a moment. Welcome back to the Campbell Conversations. I'm talking with Dan Grossman. He's a freelance environmental journalist. Well, what nations do you think offer the best models for addressing climate change right now?
Well, the European countries in general, Western European countries, are much more energy efficient than the United States. They have much higher fuel costs, and that's one of the reasons why they're more efficient, because the cost of fuel, people want to conserve because fuel is so expensive. So they have high costs of natural gas, so their heating systems are better, their insulation is better, their cars are smaller and are more efficient. So a country like Denmark, for instance, I think it basically uses about half as much energy per capita as Americans. When you go to a lot of countries like this, they don't seem like they're suffering. They don't seem like if only they could have the energy intensity of the lifestyle in the United States, that they would be happier people. In fact, there's some surveys that are done on happiness around the world, and I don't know if they're how accurate their results are, but apparently Danish people are supposed to be very happy people. So apparently the higher price of fuel and power, and the fact that they're using less fuel and power hasn't made them less happy.
And to bring it back to the United States and different version of this, what do you think is the single biggest environmental myth that American citizens walk around believing? Is it this global warming or is it something else?
Like a lot of people, I surround myself with people that are kind of like me. Mm-hmm. It's just that's the way people tend to live. So in my community, the people that I hang out with, everybody knows climate change is a problem. And yet, even in the community of my friends, most of the people that I know are doing very little about it. Those are the people who realize there's a problem. Those are the people who've heard me talking about the problem and see that I've devoted my life to trying to educate people about the problem. I think that so there are a couple of lessons I take from this. One is a lot of people think that minor tweaks to their lives will do the job, like changing light bulbs or getting a slightly more efficient car will do the job.
Or recycling a little bit or something like that. Yeah.
That's not going to do the job. It really is going to be a massive change. We have to dramatically cut back on how much fuel of various kinds that we're using. And the part of my work is not just telling people that climate change is a problem. I feel like that job's not over, but you know, there's a lot that's gone into that. That's not a debate I actually want to engage in. The issue that I want to spend time on is explaining to people, given that climate change is a problem, how serious a problem is it? Is it worth massive efforts to come to grips with it? I think it is. When you take a look at some of the damage that's being caused by climate change, and you look at some of the predictions, let's say, for how high sea level could get and what would have to be done to respond to that, that's what I'm working on. And so I think one of the myths is actually that it won't be hard, or the relatively small things will be able to respond to it. And ultimately, what's going to be required is that the price of fuel is going to have to rise, because we're all motivated by price. We know that a couple years ago, the price of oil went up, the price of gas went up. Everybody all of a sudden started talking about smaller cars. That is the way to go. We have to have more expensive fuels. Now, there are all sorts of problems with this. It'll have effects on industry. It'll have effects, differential effects on poor people. Well, you know, that's bad. We'll have to deal with those problems. But that doesn't mean that we can, just because there are some bad things that go with it, doesn't mean we can't do it. We're going to have to figure out how to do it.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Dan Grossman, environmental journalist. Well, I wanted also to ask you some questions about your own experiences and your own career path. So first, how did you go from a PhD in political science to adventurer and environmental journalist?
Well, I like to say that I'm a late bloomer. I tried a bunch of different things out, and each time I tried, it turned out it wasn't what I wanted. So I studied physics as an undergraduate. And I'd like to add that I feel like a lot of the things I tried ultimately were helpful in my career path. So it's not like I did a bunch of things that were a total waste. Although, you know, if I was going to design my life from scratch, I'd probably do it a little bit differently. But anyway, I studied physics, and at the time, it just didn't seem like being a physicist. I thought it meant being a physicist if I was going to continue in physics. Didn't want it. I just decided I didn't want to do that. Although, you know, I was fascinated with science. So, you know, I had noticed, as I finished up my undergraduate degree in physics, I was getting very interested in nuclear arms control. And I made a little documentary about nuclear arms control. And so I started getting interested in political things, although I didn't really understand what political science was at the time. I had kind of a murky idea of politics and political science because I had been steeped in science itself, hard science, and just didn't know that much about it. I didn't even read the paper that much at that point in my life, in my teens and early 20s. And so I got into political science thinking, well, you know, I'm interested in science, but it's like the policies around science that seem the most interesting, like arms control. And so I ended up doing I basically did a history of a nuclear weapons plant, the Hanford nuclear weapons plant, for my dissertation. But pretty soon after I started, actually, and I should have paid more attention to this, I realized that actually I don't really want to be a political science. I discovered journalism and science journalism. I worked as a volunteer for a little magazine that no longer exists that used to be in Cambridge. And I just started writing while I was in graduate school. And I was fortunate to hook up with someone a little bit ahead of me in the field of science journalism. So he was a bit of a mentor. And so I'm a very stubborn guy. So I continued with my degree, even though I had determined that that's not where my heart was. And then when I finally got my degree in political science, I basically just started being a journalist full time.
Well, we're getting a bit short on time here, but briefly, what projects are you working on now?
Well, I decided a few years ago that, you know, what people care most about is other people. I've done reporting on the impacts of climate change on wildlife, and I've done reporting on the very important impacts of climate change on the world's ice. But I decided that maybe if I could talk about the impacts of climate change on people around the world, that would be most gripping. And so that's what I'm doing right now. I'm going to places where I can find the best examples of either things that are happening or will happen in the near future, or efforts that people are making, however underpowered, in order to come to grips with these. So just to give you an example, I was in Peru in the spring, and I visited two really wacky kind of projects. One was a guy who was experimenting with putting sawdust on glaciers to try to save them. And whether or not mountaintop glaciers can really be protected at any scale this way, I don't know. I have my doubts. But it is true that if you put a mound of sawdust on top of a glacier, it will make a huge difference. When I went with him, the researcher, to a place where he had dumped sawdust the season before, and it was standing on the surface of the glacier like a mountain, little mountaintop, because the ice all around it had melted and the ice under the sawdust was still there. So it looked like a little plateau covered with like a crew cut of sawdust. The other thing that I saw that was really interesting was a guy who is painting mountaintops white, trying to get them to cool off just enough to grow some ice that they had before. And it sounds wacky, and I wouldn't have paid attention to it because it sounds so wacky if it weren't for the fact that they actually got a $200,000 grant from the World Bank. And so someone thinks that it has legs. I don't think it has legs. And actually, the guy told me that another one of his projects is, he didn't call it this, but as he was describing it, this guy's a tinkerer, he was describing a perpetual motion machine. So his bona fides are questionable, but it was really interesting to go and report on his work.
Well, maybe we've solved the puzzle we were talking about at the outset, that the focus on the human stories maybe is the way to communicate some of these things. But now the three questions. What's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I think I would say How I Finally Came Into My Own.
Second, what's your worst trait?
My worst trait is actually also my best trait. It's that I'm stubborn.
And third, what achievement in your creative or professional life so far has surprised you the most?
Well, I'll tell you, what surprised me the most is how long it took to get to this chapter in my life.
That was Dan Grossman. Dan, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher. Associate producers include Bethany Wallowender and Kelly Coleman, with recording engineer Tom Fazio. Learn more about the Campbell Conversations by visiting our website, wrvo.fm.